Well, it's a very great privilege to be able to introduce to this audience at LSE Mario Monti, who is now the commissioner in charge of competition in the European Union. He has a distinguished and varied career as an academic, a graduate of Bocconi University, going for a short period to other universities, Trento and Turin, before returning to Bocconi, where he became a president of that distinguished institution, and moved to become a commissioner of the European Union, in 1995. We are extremely fortunate that he has been able to spare time to talk to us today. He will speak for about 40 minutes and then has kindly agreed to answer questions. He will be talking to us about two themes that at this London School of Economics are both of very, very considerable importance, and he will be talking about the interactions between them both, namely globalization and competition. We look very much to your remarks. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Taylor, for your introductory remarks. It is, of course, a great honor and privilege for me to be here at the LSE in this old theater. Is that correct?
It is.
Old by any standard, but not on the basis of those giving me the pleasure of participating this evening. Over the years, I am aware that many Italian public figures of different political orientations have come to London, and to LSE in particular, to seek some sort of legitimacy. As some of you might know, I am also Italian, but the key word of my visit here today is more important, to me at least, than seeking legitimacy. It is rather acknowledging a debt. In fact, over three stages of my professional life, I have incurred a great debt to LSE and to the cultural climate within which LSE has been prospering and to which LSE has contributed so much in turn. As a faculty member and then rector of Bocconi University, as Professor Taylor kindly referred to, LSE was, of course, for all us, a model, if not the model. So much so that when a few weeks ago Bocconi University entered its own 100th anniversary, it came very, very natural to ask a former director of LSE, Lord Dahrendorf, to be the keynote speaker, having, of course, he authored the book on the 100 years of LSE. In the second stage of my professional life, that is the years 95 to 99 in the European Commission, when I was in charge of the single market financial services, I will omit taxation, although it was fun. I was very much working under British inspiration. As we all know, the single market is, to a very large extent, the intellectual and political product of the UK and of British thinking. And that really came very much along through the efforts of Lord Caulfield when he was in charge of the single market in the first Delors Commission. Now, in this present stage of my activity as competition commissioner, again, I find myself working in an area where the British influence has been and is strategically important. This has been so traditionally, and as most of you will know, at this very moment, this country is considering a far-reaching reform of the UK competition regime. So it's for several reasons a particular pleasure to be able to share thoughts with you in this school on globalization and competition. I must admit the subject is extremely topical and timely. Why? Well, on the 25th of October in New York, the creation of the International Competition Network was announced. On November 14 in Doha, the WTO set itself for the first time ever the objective of establishing a multilateral framework on competition policies. So in a matter of weeks, projects on which many countries of the world had been working for years saw the light, at least found acceptance. Of course, an enormous amount of work remains to be done for these projects to bear concrete fruits, but they are there. And the European Union, the Commission, the national competition authorities, the national government had been for a number of years promoting both initiatives, the International Competition Network and a multilateral agreement on competition within the WTO. And of course we are delighted to see both of them now accepted on the map. It should not be surprising, after all, that the European Union had been for years perhaps the most consistent and convinced supporter of these projects. And here is my first reflection on the interaction between globalization and competition. Why it is not surprising? Because if we think of it, in the very project of the European Union back in the 50s, we have something that is badly wanted nowadays, namely a coherent progress on one hand concerning market integration, the creation of the common market, then the single market, and at the same time the setting up of some coordination of governance. Now it is becoming realized more and more, and it's a pity that Seattle, Genoa, and the likes have been necessary for this realization to become widespread. It has become rather generally recognized that globalization has to proceed on two legs, the integration of the marketplaces, driven largely by companies themselves, and some coordination of public policy governance. Now, the European Union, for all its limitations, has had this in its genetic code since the very beginnings, since the Treaty of Rome, even before that, since the Treaty of Paris. It is only natural, therefore, that the European Union should, in recent years, have been at the forefront of movements to bring about some coordination of governance if we want to master, not certainly to impede, the globalization process and to make it more immune from backlashes. It is a bit paradoxical, though, that among the public policy powers, the antitrust powers had been relatively late in seeking forms of integration among each other at the international level. Certainly not in Europe, where since the Treaty of Rome, or indeed the Treaty of Paris, the Commission has been given the responsibility to implement the concise but pretty incisive articles in the treaty concerning antitrust and state aids. But in all the efforts over the last few years to try and organize some governance of the globalization process, the coordination of antitrust internationally had been a latecomer. Whereas, if one asks the question, which is the public policy power most immediately close to the marketplace, that is, to the place where globalization is born and driven, and which is the public policy power which is inherently most market-friendly, because it is there to guarantee the efficient functioning of the market, the answer is, of course, antitrust policy powers. That's why we are convinced, and we have pushed in this direction for the last few years, that it was high time for the antitrust authorities to come together and try to integrate a bit more than they did in the past. Of course, if one thinks of institutions such as central banks or the supervisory authorities for the financial markets, they have a much longer tradition of pretty highly structured integration and coordination. Nothing of that sort for the antitrust authorities. If the need is so clear, if the process has been somewhat late, what have been the steps to bring it about over the last few years with visible maturation over the last few weeks? The dimensions for cooperation in the antitrust areas are essentially two: bilateral cooperation between competition agencies or authorities, and multilateral cooperation. Concerning bilateral cooperation, of course, we attach a particularly crucial importance to the cooperation between the US and the EU competition agencies. This means between, in the US, the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission, and in the European Union, the Commission. The cooperation agreement was set up in 1991, more or less simultaneously. Professor Taylor to the European Institute at the LSE. It was an important year. Since then, there has been pretty intensive cooperation. You may be interested in knowing that cooperation between antitrust agencies is particularly deep, far-reaching, and I would say daily when it comes to assessing mergers. Why? Because merging companies, I should have said, because the cooperation agreements normally do not allow for the authorities to exchange confidential information, that is, business secrets, unless companies explicitly allow the authorities to do so. When two companies try to merge, they normally have an interest in the authorities in Washington and Brussels to work well together, harmoniously and fast. Therefore, they allow us to exchange information, including confidential information. Whereas, not so surprisingly, if we or our American colleagues, through inspections called DONE raids, find evidence of a cartel, you would not expect the managers of that or those companies to be enthusiastic about allowing the antitrust agencies to exchange the business secrets found on the spot. That's why the cooperation is particularly intensive in merger assessments. What we have seen over the 10 years of the US-EU cooperation in mergers is a convergence of the outcome in practically all the cases, except for a widely known recent exception, the General Electric Honeywell case, where a few months ago the Justice Department authorized the deal, whereas the European Commission prohibited the deal. Of course, that, understandably enough, made a lot of noise and attracted a lot of attention, but it is important to put that in perspective. That has been the exception, by no means the rule. In hundreds of other cases, including highly complicated ones, the outcomes have been convergent. Now, of course, this exception is important enough, and that is why in a meeting in Washington at the end of September, where our American colleagues and we took stock of the highly satisfactory results of the 10 years of cooperation, we decided that within the working group on mergers that we have, the aspect of conglomerate mergers, GE Honeywell would have been one, and the aspect of the timing in assessing mergers should be given renewed effort so that we try to understand better what has been at the origin of this exceptional divergence. The European Union has bilateral cooperation agreements also with Canada and is about to have one with Japan. Equally, the United States have a number of bilateral cooperation agreements in place. But it is an increasing belief that it is difficult to have the appropriate degree of widespread coordination among antitrust agencies if we only proceed bilaterally. That is why some thought has been given over the last few years to developing a multilateral dimension. Because, of course, the main limitation of bilateral agreements is that they do not allow the vast majority of countries having competition policies or suffering from anti-competitive practices outside their border to participate in cooperation activities and make their concerns known to the leading enforcement agencies. So that a multilateral framework is needed to complement, certainly not to substitute for, the bilateral approach and promote a competition culture among emerging antitrust authorities. We need to bear in mind that over 80 member countries of the WTO have or are in the process of establishing antitrust authorities. Cooperation between such authorities cannot be expected to be conducted on a bilateral basis alone. Administering the network of cooperative arrangements would be prohibitively burdensome. That is the background against which the two recent initiatives have seen the light, the WTO and the International Competition Network. Let me say a few words on each. The WTO had established, at the initiative of the European Commission in 1996, a working group on trade and competition. And a lot of interesting technical work has been done in that context. In fact, because of the complementary relationship between trade and competition policy, The WTO appears to be the institution best suited to house such a framework. The WTO also has the advantages of a very broad membership, broader, of course, than the OECD, for example, and a tradition of enforcing binding rules. The incorporation of a competition dimension of this kind into the organization of the WTO serves, moreover, to underpin the impressive progress which has been made in trade liberalization over the past few decades by facilitating effective action against anti-competitive behavior, which might otherwise have the effect of undermining that same progress, because it's very important to have brought down almost completely trade barriers, to have taken care of non-trade restrictions, non-tariff restrictions to trade, but the advantages of having a free market internationally would be severely undermined if on that free marketplace we had obstacles erected by companies, no longer by governments, through cartels, through abuses of dominant positions, through mergers unchecked and therefore likely to create or strengthen dominant positions. That is why there is a logical complementarity between trade liberalization and the establishment and the maintenance of a competitive marketplace. Just like in Europe, we go back to our own historical precedent, it made sense on one hand to reduce, to eliminate obstacles to trade, and on the other hand to enforce rules against cartels, against abuse of dominant positions, and so on. The Doha Declaration of November 14 sets for the first time, as I mentioned, the objective of establishing a multilateral framework on competition policies. What do we expect from that, and what don't we do not expect from that? This should contribute towards the more effective application of domestic competition regimes and be of benefit for consumers around the world. Negotiations will be preceded by a preparatory phase. We Europeans would have liked, as you might know, to have the negotiation, the decision on negotiations taken at Doha already, but some other countries around the world were more reluctant, and therefore the start of the actual negotiations will be preceded by a preparatory phase until the fifth ministerial meeting of the WTO, that is in a couple of years. We do not envisage, neither now nor for later, to set up a world competition organization. This would be, in this historical phase, to say the least, unrealistic. Nor do we want to have the decisions taken by the individual jurisdictions, say the US, the EU, Canada, Japan, and so on, appealed within the context of the WTO. So the individual decisions will stay where they are. Of course, they will be influenced where there are bilateral cooperation agreements by the mutual exchanges within those frameworks of cooperation. But the individual decisions will stay with the jurisdictions. But the value added of a WTO agreement will be that the WTO will agree on a few core principles guiding antitrust legislation and policy in all member states of the WTO. Agreements, principles like non-discrimination between domestic companies and foreign companies, like transparency, like due process, and a few others. So there will be a peer review and a mechanism of monitoring, not on the individual decisions taken in particular case by the various jurisdictions, but on the extent to which the various laws comply with the core principles that hopefully will be agreed. This will be a binding exercise, an exercise bringing to a few core principles agreed with a binding value, as is customary within the WTO. The other initiative which I mentioned, the International Competition Network, is something purely among the competition authorities, whereas the WTO involves national governments, and it is a consensus-based initiative which has just left the drawing board and was announced, as I said, at the end of October in New York. This ICN, International Competition Network, is open to national or multinational, like in our case, competition authorities responsible for the enforcement of antitrust laws. It will also seek advice and input from the private sector, non-governmental organizations, consumer groups, lawyers, economists, and members of the academic community. Initially, the ICN will focus on the merger control process as it applies to multinational mergers and on the competition advocacy role of antitrust agencies, particularly in developing emerging and transition economies. I should underline this dimension very much because, after all, if it were only for the US, the EU, Canada, Japan, the need for these multilateral exercises would be slightly less relevant. But if we think of the dozens and dozens of countries where there is a newly born or still to be born competition law and competition agency, then the need for convergence is important, and also the need for the domestic competition agencies in those countries to be recognized as belonging to a common culture of competition. You might detect from what you read in the press concerning individual competition policy decisions that they tend to generate tensions. Inevitably, no company likes to be fined for a cartel. No company likes, even though it is a pretty rare event, to see a merger that it wanted to put in place prohibited. So there are inevitably tensions. It is relatively easy for long-established competition agencies like the ones in Washington, like the European Commission, like the national competition authorities in our member states, to face these tensions because the importance of competition is recognized in our societies. For the, if you think of being a competition agency in a developing country, the process of establishing authority and credibility domestically vis-à-vis varied constituencies is a tough one. It may be facilitated if everybody in the country perceives that what their national competition authority is doing is observed internationally, and if that competition authority can feel as belonging to a growing common culture. I believe this is really very important. That's why we are delighted of the progress made in establishing these new multilateral initiatives. I think, Mr. Chairman, that it is normally more interesting to have a question and answers period than to have a lengthy presentation of, even if it might be on occasions, interesting series of remarks. And I'm not pretending that this subject is so exciting. Whereas I know by experience that individual competition policy decisions may even get exciting. At any rate, people are very excited about them frequently. So I would be delighted within the boundaries of my obligations to discretion concerning certain subjects, I'd be delighted on the occasion of questions to try and give more concreteness to what competition policy is in a down-to-earth sense after we have examined briefly together how it could fly high in terms of globalization and bilateral and multilateral cooperation. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. Our speaker has very kindly agreed to answer a few of your questions. So if any of you care to put your hand up, we can take some questions now.
Commissioner Monti, can you please comment a bit on the globalization of state aid regime, on the interplay of the EC state aid regime with the WTO subsidy regime? In particular, I'm referring after the tragic events of the 11th of September to the different attitudes that we have seen in the airline sector of, on the one side, the United States, and on the other side, the European Union.
Can answer from here. Well, your example about the airlines associated with my reference to down to earth is a bit scaring. But thank you for having raised the issue of state aid, which is not normally talked about in discussions about international cooperation and competition. Whereas I believe that it is of crucial importance, as you seem to do. Why is it little discussed? Because of a peculiarity of the European regime here. The Commission is an antitrust, well, is much more than an antitrust agency, but there is a tiny department within the Commission which is involved in implementing competition policy. It also has to implement state aid control, and the department and the commissioner are the same for antitrust and state aid control. Why is it so? Because of course the Commission is a supranational body, and therefore it has the legitimacy under the treaty to have a say in the subsidies granted by the governments of member states to companies. Our colleagues in other jurisdictions, the national jurisdictions in Europe or the US or elsewhere, do not have this competence, because in the constitutional regime of a country, it would be difficult to foresee that an antitrust agency, besides having powers concerning the behavior of companies, would also have the power to undo what the executive and the legislative may have done in terms of subsidizing companies. Whereas under the Rome Treaty in Europe, the Commission has this responsibility, because the founding fathers thought it would not be so helpful to have a single market distorted by state aids. You're perfectly right in saying that there is there some need for coordination of state aid control. We are much less advanced, also for the reason I just mentioned. There are, yes, in the OECD, in the WTO, some pretty basic rules, especially for some sectors. But the cooperation in this area is inevitably much more rudimentary and less developed than in antitrust. Now, you point to the post-September 11 events and the airlines industry. I will make two observations here. You are right that the European Union has taken a stricter attitude for a number of reasons, but it has taken a stricter attitude. We have, and here I say we, not out of modesty, but because transport is one of the only three sectors, the two others being agriculture and fishery, where state aid control within the Commission is the responsibility not of of the competition commissioner, but of the sectoral commissioner, in this case Mrs. Loyola de Palacio. So we, under her leadership, have taken in the Commission a pretty stringent position on state aid to airlines, authorizing only very limited aids relative to the US. More broadly, it is our view that should there be a substantial economic downturn, it would be an extremely dangerous response to take care of that through a generous state aid policy. Say the airlines first, then the insurance, then the tourist industry, and so on, through a sort of domino effect of state aid generosity. In my view, I have a firm conviction about this. Should there be, let's hope that there isn't a big economic downturn, but should there be a substantial economic downturn involving several sectors, the appropriate response can only be a macroeconomic one, not one of state aid to sector after sector, because it would be really very damaging to put in danger the single market as a structural phenomenon in response to what would be a conjunctural, a macroeconomic development.
Question there.
Igor Tielemann, Government Department. You mentioned the importance of transparency when it comes to competition decisions. And one criticism that has often been made about the competition in this area has been a lack of transparency. And I just wonder now if there is now an attempt to coordinate antitrust policy at the WTO measure. Isn't there a danger of perhaps further undermining transparencies and removing decisions further from the actual addressees of decisions? Is that a concern of the Commission, and is there anything that the Commission can do in order to address these concerns?
Transparency here too is of great importance. Let's take the WTO dimension first. As I said, no one envisages that individual decisions be taken by the WTO. So the WTO would set the standards concerning the key features of competition laws, would see whether countries comply with those standards, but would not become involved in individual decisions. Therefore, the transparency, if anything, the WTO will see to it that in the laws about competition, the principle of transparency is enshrined. So there can only be progress from that point of view. Then the individual decisions will have to be transparent. Now, transparent is a multifaceted word, of course. For example, when people compare the US and the EU system of merger control, some argue that the extent to which the Commission's decisions are subject to judicial review is more limited than in the US. something could be said in this respect, but the same people normally stress that the process is more transparent in the EU because, for example, when we decide that a merger poses serious competition concerns and deserves a closer scrutiny, we issue to the companies concerned a statement of objections, which is an articulated and documented reasoning about the problems we see. In the US, when they do the similar thing, which is the second request, they do not have the obligation to articulate their concerns. So I take the point about the importance of transparency. I believe it should be kept as a high priority at all stages of the procedure. I don't see a WTO development undermining this. If anything, it can raise the standards.
We have one question up there, and then I see two, three down here. You're next. There was a question up there. Right.
Fabio Franchino from the Department of Government. Some time ago, the Commission has published a white paper on the reform of the competition policy. I would say actually a path-breaking white paper.
Heartbreaking?
Path-breaking.
That is reassuring.
Well, why not? One of the key aspects of that paper was the transfer of some of the key policy competencies from the Commission to the, especially to the national judiciary system, through a system of private litigation. There are two very simple questions. What was the rationale behind such a proposal? And second, to what extent would you see that that will be actually accomplished?
I didn't get the second.
To what extent such a proposal will be actually accomplished? Thanks.
Yeah. This is a fairly technical question, which I will try to address in relatively non-technical terms. The core of the issue is one paragraph in Article 81 of the Treaty of Rome. Article 81 establishes the rules. Says that agreements between companies, if they are restrictive, are a bad thing. But paragraph 3 of Article 81 says that the provisions of paragraph 1, which I summarized brutally, may, however, be declared inapplicable in the case of agreements which contribute to improving the production or distribution of goods or to promoting technical or economic progress while allowing consumers a fair share of the resulting benefit. Against this general standard of prohibition of agreements, there is this possibility to show that the agreement is not so bad, may even be good. Who, under the presently existing system, does this assessment? Only the European Commission. Because Regulation 17, introduced in 1962 to implement the treaty, says that only the Commission has this power. Now, we believe that this monopoly given to the Commission was justified at the time, 1962, a desert landscape concerning competition culture in Europe, because there were in Bonn the Bundeskartellamt, in Brussels the European Commission, and in no other country were there national competition authorities. Also, there was no case law about community competition law. how could companies know, how could their lawyers know whether a certain agreement might be exempted? Now, 40 or so years ago, the situation is profoundly different. Each country, including the candidate countries, now has a competition authority. There is a huge case law of the Commission and of the European Court of Justice. The awareness of companies is much greater. So we have, through the path-breaking white book, introduced a new approach, which we believe goes very much in the sense of subsidiarity and simplification, and has the national competition authorities and the national courts, as you rightly noted, share this power with the European Commission. At the same time, the obligation to notify all agreements is eliminated. So this is the rationale. Subsidiarity, simplification, allowing the Commission to concentrate on what is really relevant at the EU level, now that others can cooperate in the joint effort. And by the way, this is an example, in my view, of what the Commission should try hard to do in many areas, that is, stick to the core competences and devolve or eliminate altogether other unnecessary business. The acceptance of this proposal, now the draft regulation which the Commission, on the basis of the White Book, has adopted in September last year, has gained the favorable opinion of the European Parliament, is now under pretty advanced discussion in the Council. I'm confident that in the course of next year we will have adoption, so that when the first new member states show up, they will find a pretty deeply reformed architecture of competition policy in Europe.
Question there?
Given that you emphasized that the General Electric and Honeywell case was pretty much an exception, can we expect that the European Commission will reach the same conclusions in Microsoft case as US Department of Justice, and also your views in general, as much as you can give us, obviously, on the investigation in the US? Thank you.
It's only coherent after the praise I gave to transparency that you should ask that question, on which you will be bitterly disappointed in terms of a forthcoming response. I referred to merger control. GE Honeywell was, of course, a case of mergers, not Microsoft. There, the procedure that is going on at the European Commission is one under Article 82 of the Treaty of alleged abuse of a dominant position, nothing to do with mergers. I should add that the equivalent to abuse of dominant position under the US system is monopolization. You will be thoroughly familiar with the US case concerning Microsoft. The US and the EU cases are factually and legally distinct, and therefore it wouldn't at any rate be very easy to identify divergences. At any rate, it's vastly premature for me to give any indication about what the outcome of the EU procedure on Microsoft might be. Concerning GE Honeywell, I already said it has been an important divergence. It has been the exception, not the rule. For those of you interested to the extent to which there are differences in merger control in Washington and Brussels, may I give a reference to a very recent paper which I found helpful by David Walton, Transatlantic Differences in Merger Policy, Not Such a Big Deal.
published by Goldman Sachs on 26 October 2001.
I think we have time for two more questions. I did see two questions down here. Perhaps you first.
Hi, well, I'm not going to ask you about G. Honeywell or Air Tours or Microsoft, or, but I am going to ask about merge control. The substantive test, dominance, do you think that it's intellectually honest and also legislatively possible to keep the same substantive test for merger control, given the increase in the number of mergers that we've had, the increase in their complexity, and the rise of concepts such as collective dominance, indirect effects, conglomerate effects, portfolio power, collective abuse of a collective dominant position? Do you think it's possible that the substantive test in the merger regulation can cope with these ideas?
Can I translate your question for even though it's of course superfluous, but the substantive test, and please correct me if the translation is not right, the substantive test is the test against which a given antitrust agency, in our case the Commission, has to accept or not accept a merger. The substantive test under the merger regulation in Europe is whether a merger creates or strengthens a dominant position. If it does, it cannot be authorized unless the parties propose remedies that cope with the competition concerns. No, you need not write down. I'm simply translating you. under the U.S. system, for example, the substantive test is phrased differently. They have to assess whether there is a substantial lessening of competition. Now, you then very pointedly listed a number of aspects, parameters, and circumstances which make our job not so easy, whether it is conducted in Brussels or elsewhere, collective dominance, conglomerate mergers, portfolio effects, etc., etc. And you stressed the growing complexity of mergers. By the way, I find it rather remarkable that we stay altogether in merger control by the European Commission at a prohibition rate of around 2% of the mergers notified, in spite of the huge increase in the complexity of the mergers filed over the last couple of years, and of the fact that each successive merger in a given sector starts off from a higher and higher degree of concentration. All the points you mention must find their place in the analysis, and I would tend to say that they do find their place in the analysis. It does not seem to me that they are clearly correlated to what substantive test a jurisdiction adopts. I mean, we have creation or strengthening of dominant position. The assessment is made certainly more complicated by all your list. Our colleagues in Washington have the substantial lessening of competition. Their assessment is made equally more complicated by the existence of those factors. Finally, I will say that in the month of December, I will propose to the Commission the publication of a green paper on merger control, which is due as a midterm review under the merger regulation, which is expected to open a wide debate. And perhaps in that context also the issue of which substantial test, which substantive test could be raised.
We have two more questions.
Yeah.
So I think two questions, one there and one there. Okay, you go first.
Right. Giacomo Benedetto, Department of Government. You've mentioned mergers and acquisitions, and you've mentioned dominant positions. I'm wondering what kind of powers you're able to use to regulate monopolization in the media sector. And I'm thinking in particular of the dominant positions of the interests of Mr. Murdoch and Mr. Berlusconi.
The media have one aspect in common with other industries and one aspect which is peculiar to them. The aspect in common is the impact on competition, the competitive situation in their own marketplace. The aspect which is peculiar is the issue of plurality or pluralism in the media. During the previous commission, when I was commissioner for the single market, I tried to introduce a draft directive on media and pluralism. Under the single market angle. In the EU system, it's for individual member states to have their visions and rules on pluralism and the link between pluralism and democracy and all that. But I was concerned at the time that the fact that more and more member states were introducing measures to protect pluralism, a good thing, but in a disparate way, might undermine the creation of a single market for media. That's why I tried to introduce this, I must say, unsuccessfully. Now, being in charge of competition in the current Prodi Commission, I look at these problems when they materialize. I look at these problems when they materialize, that is, whether there are mergers which are notified or agreements or abuse of dominant position. And some of the mergers that we have assessed include the media industry.
I think one last question.
Thank you. I wanted to ask about the guidelines that you mentioned, which would be set within the WTO framework. Specifically, how precise will those guidelines be? I'm thinking that it's quite difficult for international companies to assess at the moment where to notify on the basis of certain tests in certain jurisdictions which may have just a worldwide threshold or no effects required in the jurisdiction. And also in relation to notification times, for instance, in Brazil at the moment it's quite difficult to judge when one needs to notify. I understand that letters of intent or letters of confidentiality may even trigger the notification date. And if, in relation to those guidelines, will the EU take the lead in setting them? Thank you.
The WTO, when the negotiations will effectively start, will aim at establishing agreement on core principles of competition law and policy, such as non-discrimination, transparency, due process. I believe that the very concrete and tangible problem to which you refer, that is the complexity of multi-jurisdictional mergers, is more likely to be dealt with in the context of the ICN, of the International Competition Network. And as I believe I hinted at, the first project will indeed be the examination of with the input of the business community and of lawyers, what can be done to simplify life to companies which are engaging in multi-jurisdictional mergers in terms, exactly as you say, of the timing of the notifications, the modalities, and so on. Because I believe that competition policy is, of course, there to protect consumers. I believe it should be a vigorous competition policy, but it should not unnecessarily harm companies. And nowadays, companies really find it extremely burdensome and costly and subject to a high degree of unpredictability when they have to complete a merger involving many, many jurisdictions. So whatever can be done to tackle this problem, I believe in a highly pragmatic manner, needs to be done. And the ICN is probably the first place where this effort will be planted and hopefully will generate fruits.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm sure that you would wish me on behalf of us all to thank our speaker for his splendid answers to your questions, but also for a very stimulating and informative presentation. We are in your debt. And thank you very much indeed.